Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. So here we are in mid-September, National Recovery Month, and we're going to be checking in with our partners from Aware Recovery Care to remind you about their unique, successful in-home recovery program, along with the critical roles played by loved ones as part of the recovery team, and not just the ones shouldering the entire challenge. Then, as misinformation continues to pervade conversations about elections and voting security, we're going to circle back to have another very enlightening and maybe a little bit concerning conversation with our source from the Election Cybersecurity Initiative at USC's Annenberg Center on Communications Leadership and Policy, who just held a workshop here in Connecticut a few weeks ago. Then we're going to reconnect on the issue of the crisis in nursing staffing here in the state and across the nation while celebrating the 42nd annual RN Student Day with the newly consolidated Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce. If you're a nurse, you love one, or need one, this is a segment you're going to want to hear. We'll be right back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Hey, veterans out there, Stand Down 2022 is open to you. All veterans and service members, including active duty National Guard and Reserve personnel. It's happening this Friday, September 23rd, providing attendees a access to a variety of in-person services, including housing opportunities, legal assistance, employment programs, medical screenings, education, personal needs, vaccinations, and meals provided by the DVA, Federal VA, veterans organizations, and many other state and federal agencies and community providers. Regional locations will be open from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University of Bridgeport, the Bristol Sports Armory, the Danbury War Memorial, and the Connecticut DVA Rocky Hill Campus. Learn more now by visiting portal.ct.gov/DVD. So as we mentioned in our introduction this morning, we are here in September, National Recovery Month, and one of our radio station's great partners here in Connecticut is Aware Recovery Care. They provide innovative substance use disorder treatment with an approach that's really simple, direct, and it works. They believe every person deserves and can achieve lasting recovery without having to leave their home. Dr. Shelley Halligan is back with us again. She's Vice President of Medical Services for Aware Recovery Care. Shelley, if I may call you that, how is everything
going? Absolutely.
How's everything going here during Recovery Month?
It's going very well. It's very very nice to have me back here with you today and talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that is recovery.
So people may have heard, commercials and other marketing that we're airing on our radio stations and on our websites. But for those who may know someone or love someone who could use recovery support, or an individual themselves who may be coming out of COVID and the COVID era that we've been through, saying, wow, I've really started consuming a lot more alcohol than I want to, or worse, we've been, exposed to opioids or other addictive substances, and we really need to put a stop to this. Tell us a little bit about how Aware Recovery Care really works in this innovative approach that you guys have.
Absolutely. So Aware is, like you said, it's very innovative. It's very out of the box and unique. So an individual has, like you said, they may find themselves in a situation where they're abusing prescription medication, using alcohol or other illicit substances, and may need help. Aware is up to a 52-week in-home addiction treatment program where we actually age, gender, and story match the team to the individual and provide all the services in the person's home, which is such a sacred place for us to be. The other really unique thing that we do is we include the family as part of the treatment team. You know, it's very different than in a person going away to an inpatient facility for 30, 60, 90 days, which they may need to do. We certainly partner with a lot of inpatient support and facilities. But this approach allows individuals to stay at home with their family, with their friends, with their pets, in their own bed, and really be able to include the family and their network in their recovery process.
Well, we're going to dive a lot deeper and talk to directly to those family members that may be coming engaged in the support and recovery of a loved one in just a couple of minutes. But I really want to hear a lot more about your team and the types of expertise that are being strategically matched to each individual client that comes to Aware Recovery Care. What are the types of expertise that are being invited into the homes of individuals who really want to get their lives back under control?
Great question. So when the person is referred, or when they call in themselves, they can actually call, they can call into Aware and they can refer themselves, or a family member, they can call to get information themselves. They're getting all the information that they possibly can. What substance are they using? What is the treatment history? What is the medical comorbidities that they individual have? They need detox. Are they safe? That's our number one priority. And then we start developing that treatment plan right away. And that treatment plan development begins with a psychiatrist, our medical directors, nurse practitioners, psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. And we look at the overall picture and we'll do a full assessment of the individual. The team is made up with a nurse, a social worker. Those individuals are kind of our care coordinators. They really work with the providers in the community because we want primary care involved. We want your OBGYN involved. We want your whomever is part of your medical team involved in this care as well. So that part of it is set up. When we look at your therapy, do you need therapy? We have in-house therapy that we work with the patient, and we also do therapy with the family. We also look at the family system. So we know that the individual themselves are struggling with substance use disorder, but the individual is not usually the only person that has a problem, right? It usually the system is broken, meaning that the family has been trying to help with the patient. They're trying to manage their jobs. They're trying to help them with legal issues. So mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters suddenly become case managers, suddenly become, monitoring this individual, making sure that they're okay. We want people to become back to those relationships. So we want to step in as the experts and become the substance use disorder treatment experts so that the family members can get back to their place. So we have family education facilitators that work with the family. Teach them about addiction, teach them about what is going on inside the brain when addiction does take over the person's lives, because it's not a moral failing. It's not a judgment. It's not a choice. These individuals, what happens in the brain, alcohol now becomes making all the decisions for the person, or the opiates, they make all the decisions for the person. So we give the family a really good sounding board, a lot of education, and a lot of support so they're able to understand how to work with the loved one that's in their life. And then we have certified recovery advisors, and these are the individuals that have lived experience. And these individuals are absolute amazing rock stars. They develop that trust that they can look at across the table from that individual and they say, I've been exactly in your shoes. I know exactly what it's like. Yes, I put alcohol in my shampoo bottle too. Yes, I stole and I did these things too. They really normalize that the things that people have so much shame and guilt over, that is what keeps people sick and suffering for so long. People are actually afraid to talk to their provider sometimes about the substances they're abusing because they're afraid of what they're going to hear. When you say something to someone that says, I can't stop drinking, I drink all day, and they look at you and they say, well, why wouldn't you do that? Or just stop, or just say no. Well, that shuts off the conversation, right? But if you have somebody that says, I understand, I've been there, I can relate to what you're doing, and I'm going to help you rewrite your story, and I'm going to walk beside you while you do it. That's a game changer for most individuals with substance use disorder.
So at this point, I guess one of the most important things I could ask you to speak to is the individuals who are doing diagnosis and treatment by Google. They're strictly relying on either social networks or web searching to try to get the answers to do it themselves. I don't imagine that from 10,000 feet, you're seeing an equal level or even a fractional level of success taking that route.
You know, it's all over the place. I kind of equate it to, you know, I don't know anything about working on cars. I can Google and look to see what this noise might be in my car. I might get it right. I might not. And if I start taking my car apart and adding different things to it, or maybe not the right oil or maybe not the right gas, I can do actually more damage to my car than if I took it to an expert. Exact same thing with substance use disorder. You know, I can Google, hey, this substance will help this, or this will help this, or take this amount of herbs. But what may really be happening is you may be causing more damage. You may be causing yourself more problems. So, you know, I can understand that people are desperate and they're fearful. And a lot of that is because, like I said, the shame. Yeah. So they want to fix it themselves. And I understand that. I mean, most of us in this field, we have such compassion and so much empathy that there's no judgment. I mean, I get it. I understand why people would want to be able to do that. But allow experts in the field of substance use disorder give you the right tools, the right medication possibly, the right resources to be able to find recovery. And now I want to say whatever that looks like for you, because people's recovery can look very, very different, and that's okay. We understand that at AWARE. So your recovery might look different than my recovery. My recovery is going to look different than my neighbor's recovery, and we understand that. And I think that's the other piece that's very unique about AWARE. Is very client-centered. We come and, you know, I've had people that'll say, I don't want to stop drinking altogether. I want to learn how to drink on the weekends. I want to do this. I want to do that. And the likelihood of them accomplishing that is up in the air. It may not be total abstinence for every single person. What we are trying to do is save individuals' lives. We are seeing more people die than we ever have in our entire careers from substance use disorder. So we're at the point now, we want to save your life, not tell you how you should recover.
So in the last minute or so that we have with you, Shelley, what a call from a loved one to AWARE Recovery Care will bring is relief from being a forced into, as you so aptly pointed out earlier, being a case manager for this loved one, to being a cheerleader and part of the actual solution and support network. And that's why the call from the loved one to AWARE Recovery Care is really the most important way to start. And you can go online and go to awarerecoverycare.com and get comfortable with what the organization can offer before you make the call. And that's what's most important. But here in September, National Recovery Month, it's time for loved ones to step up, forget the stigmas, and play a role in making it happen.
And it's a courageous call. I just want to say it's a very courageous call, because families are fearful and families are terrified. And they're terrified of losing their loved one, but they're also terrified of making a disconnection. So maybe that, I'll hurt or damage the relationship. You are going to love your family to death if you don't make the call. So it's a courageous call, but it's one of love and compassion. And if you have that suspicion, if you have that pit in your stomach, if you know this person has a problem, pick up the phone and call us. There will be no judgment. There will be no big sales pitch. It will be, we're going to get you help. We understand where you are, and we want to see you thrive, and we want to see your loved one thrive.
With the most important component being it's all happening in the privacy and comfort and security of your own home. Dr. Shelley Halligan is VP of Medical Services for Aware Recovery Care. Folks, it's Recovery Month, but every month is Recovery Month. If you're a loved one
That's
of
right.
an individual with an addiction, go to awarerecoverycare.com and make that brave call today. Shelley, thank you so much. Well, with the primaries behind us and a few special elections across the state and the region, now our full attention turns to November and Election Day. And I mean, we have not skipped a day or perhaps even a moment where you could open up a newspaper, turn on a news program or a radio program anywhere across the media and the news. We continue to hear about concerns and allegations about election fraud and concerns about issues having to do with the security of our votes. So we're so pleased to welcome back our friend Adam Clayton Powell III. He's Executive Director of Election Cybersecurity Initiative at USC's Annenberg Center on Communication, Leadership, and Policy. And we recently welcomed him and his team back to Connecticut for the New England Regional Election Cybersecurity Workshop. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the important discussions and matters that transacted then. But in the meantime, Adam, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Good to be with you again. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, appreciate that. So before we get into talking about what happened a couple of weeks ago here at the latest cybersecurity workshop, I'm hearing great news about your initiative, not just going nationwide, but now going global. Tell us a little bit about that.
If there has been more interest than we expected in what we're doing here in the United States to secure elections in other countries, that democracies around the world are threatened by cybersecurity issues, threatened by disinformation and misinformation. And we've been invited now to do programs in Europe, and we'll be doing a program in the fall in Africa, and one in the winter in Asia. So democracies everywhere are seeing some of these same issues, and they want to partner with us to see how we can help them as well as how they can help us.
So as you prepare for taking the knowledge that you and your team have outside of the United States, how much time and work and preparation has to go into actually learning both about the practices and the logistics of how elections are conducted in these other countries?
Well, the United States has almost the extreme case of decentralized elections, and people in other countries are amazed that we have 8,000 election districts with different election laws in each state and different election laws within each state, and that there are different dates when people can vote, ranging as you go from state to state. So the program we did, for example, in June in Greece, we learned quite a bit from our partners there. And in fact, before we left, I did some research and saw that in the annual ranking of cybersecurity, of the strength of nations in cybersecurity, which is done each year by Estonia, which is always highly rated in cybersecurity, they actually rated Greece as the number one country in the world on cybersecurity. And so my view was, okay, please tell us how you do it, how you got to be number one. The U.S., by the way, was ranked number 21.
Well, then it's probably statistics like that that, kind of provide the impetus for the critics who have been a constant drumbeat of opposition in regards to the last presidential election and a number of others since then. I mean, you know, we've heard claims of individuals who have gotten just a few percent of their overall vote in their elections, refusing to accept them because they feel that there's been some sort of manipulation of votes. Could you say, in terms of the experience that you've had, Adam, how many or what the proportion is of people who think there's actually manual manipulation versus an overarching suspicion that the manipulation of elections or the outcome of elections have been victims, in a sense, of cybersecurity breaches?
Well, the good news is that despite what we hear day to day, and as you said earlier, even hour to hour about cybersecurity issues, our elections in the United States are much more secure today than they were 6 years ago. 2016 was a real wake-up call for everybody when the Democratic National Committee email was hacked. And we happened to be in the right place at the right time. The person who co-invented the Internet in 2015 had urged us to form a multidisciplinary cybersecurity team to deal with securing devices of all kinds connected to the Internet. So when the 2016 Democratic National Committee email breach occurred, we were approached quite soon afterward by the National Governors Association saying, please be our research partner on this. And so we've been working on this now for more than 6 years. And I can tell you without any fear of contradiction that in each of the 50 states throughout the United States, security is much tighter than it was in 2016, and I would say in almost every state, tighter than it was in 2018. We're still not there yet. Pennsylvania, for example, said they're not going to be fully secure until 2026. So it's not easy to do. It can be a bit cumbersome and costly, but it's much better now than it was before, and it's getting better. The problems that we have, the United States is now has a problem which is shared by democracies everywhere, and it's not new, which is when the election is very, very close, you have people who doubt the outcome. And just think of Georgia, the Georgia gubernatorial election in 2018, when some Democrats still don't accept that they lost the election. You go back to some very close presidential elections, and I'm old enough to remember. I was in school, but I'm old enough to remember 1960 when I got up on Wednesday morning and we still didn't know whether Kennedy or Nixon had won. And it came down to a few thousand votes in Illinois. So we've had very close elections and controversies coming out of very close elections. But the cybersecurity element is what's new. I mean, in 1960, people worried about what Mayor Daley was doing in Chicago in terms of what may or may not have happened in voting there. But now we have concerns about the very technology which we thought would advance our elections and election returns is now subject to attack by those with the technological knowledge and capabilities, and at the top of the very list, the people who are the bad actors in this are Russia. Everybody's list. Russia has devoted R&D to figuring out the best ways to attack us. They've devoted resources. They've hired a lot of people. And what Putin even did was he started multiple departments in their government that compete with each other to see who can hack into the United States better than the other. So please the boss by causing turmoil in America.
We're going to pause here and take a brief break, but stay tuned. We're going to be back to talk more about cybersecurity and the security of your votes at election time with Adam Powell. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, new parents and their babies and toddlers have several new opportunities this fall to have fun, learn new things, enjoy music, playtime, and make new friends in a new playgroup class being offered at the Therapy Center at Abelis in Stamford. Baby and Me offers separate classes for ages 0 to 6 months, 7 to 12 months, and 13 to 18 months, while My Toddler and Me offers a class for 2 to 3-year-olds. Both programs are on Mondays and run for 6 weeks with classes on October 3rd through 21. Each program is $200 for the 6 classes, and registration can be made online at abelis.us or by calling 324-1880. Once again, that login for online registration is abilis.us. That's abilis.us. Well, we're going to pick up on our conversation on election cybersecurity with Adam Powell. Well, that being said, Adam, is there something to learn once an expert like yourself or one of your peers begins to figure out the newest and, most insidious ways that the cybersecurity of elections and their related matters, face possible infiltration?
Well, the good news is that there are some precautions that are very, very simple. We work with one of the leading experts in corporate cybersecurity. He does training sessions for CEOs and boards of directors for Fortune 100 companies and for at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And he said, there's some very simple things. If you see anything starting to go wrong, pull the plug, unplug your computer, take it offline. And he used the example of a cyber attack that Russia staged on Ukraine, where they attacked all 6 of the Ukrainian electric power centers. And in 5 of the centers, the lights went out. In the 6th center, the operator who was at the console saw something that he didn't like, and he literally pulled the Ethernet cable out of the back of the console, and the lights stayed on in that part of the country. Hmm. So he said, don't be afraid to pull the plug. You can always plug it back in if nothing's wrong. Another, which has now spread throughout the United States, all 50 states, is for elections, which are such critical infrastructure, your major election systems should not be plugged into the internet. And that ranges from New Hampshire, where they've always been proud of being completely on paper, and their Secretary of State used to say, you can't hack a pencil, to states that have a greater reliance on computerized systems. But now I think everybody realizes in all 50 states, election officials in all 50 states realize you have to keep that computer equipment unplugged from the internet, especially during voting, when voting is going on. The other thing that's starting to happen, which is good news, is that more and more political campaigns now realize that they're targets. They've been warned by both parties, the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee. They say to candidates, before you announce, get your cybersecurity in shape, because the moment you are a candidate, you're going to start to be attacked. So now candidates, ranging down to some of the most local town and county candidates, realize that they have to take basic cybersecurity precautions, because there are bad actors out there. Even foreign intelligence agencies, they're now targeting low-level candidates in the United States. And one person told me it's the lesson they learned in 2004, when they didn't pay attention to this, then little-known, certainly outside the United States, little-known state legislator in Illinois, And 4 years later, in 2008, he becomes the most powerful person on the planet. So now they're looking at the local elections around the country. These are foreign intelligence services. They look at local election candidates around the United States, gathering up information about them and that can be used against them in the event that they become leaders in the United States.
Hmm. So that being said, tell us a little bit about your latest session here for New England. You were up with your team in mid-August. What was that all about?
Well, it was an interesting example of what we've seen. This is the third year we've been going to the 50 states. And what we've seen now is that we are getting ever more senior people interested in being part of our program. We had Senator Chris Murphy do a welcome. We had Senator Angus King from Maine do a welcome. We had members of Congress. We had the Secretary of State from Maine. So we have ever more senior people who understand this is a problem. Angus King in Maine, he actually said that he said we should put the fear of God into election officials. Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, I think people realize this is a problem. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, the Pew Research Center released some interesting data where they asked people around the United States, what are you afraid of? And the number one and number two things that people were afraid of, not just for elections, they were afraid of cyber attacks and misinformation. And there's so much in ransomware attacks now that go after towns and villages and small school systems and hospitals that I think people really understand that beyond the problem with elections, that this is just a major issue which has to be addressed by all of us.
So looking forward to this coming election day, in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Adam, what are a couple of parting messages that you can say to folks that are listening? You've made a few points of good news throughout our conversation. What do we need to know and look out for as we head toward Election Day 2022?
Well, the good news, as I said, is that things are getting better. The problem is that we are quite far away from being perfect. In fact, 2 weeks ago, MIT released a study showing that the Chinese have been hacking into political and human rights organizations for years, taking advantage of very, very simple cybersecurity lapses that they find. Bad passwords, people not having multi-factor authentication, very simple things like that. Anybody who uses a word, an English language word, as a password is vulnerable because, guess what? Our adversaries have a list of those words. We call it the dictionary. And they have software that will try thousands and even millions of words trying to crack your password. And it could be to get into your political organization. It could be to get into your bank account. This is something that we all need to know and be aware that we, each and every one of us, has to take precautions to protect ourselves, as well as what our initiative is trying to do, which is to protect our democracy.
So for the average person, the way we use passwords has changed a lot. We get a lot of advice about, changing them, having multi-factor identification. But it sounds like there really is no certain way to be able to protect, a non-expert who has the wherewithal to perhaps make complicated changes in passcodes on a daily or weekly basis.
You don't need to go that far. The Secretary of State of Kentucky had a wonderful image in our workshop there. He said, we see the Russians trying to get in, and we see the Chinese and North Koreans and Iranians, and we see them, and his image was, he said, we see them trying the doorknobs. And if they don't get in right away, they go down the street and try somebody else's doorknob. So for more than 90% of the cases, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to have enough security so that it makes the bad guys go someplace else. I'll give you another great metaphor. The Secretary of State of Minnesota, who's done three of our workshops, he said, look, if you're up against the Russian experts in St. Petersburg and they're after your documents, it's really tough to be that secure. He said, but what you want to be is just secure enough to cause them trouble. So when they try to get into your account, they can't quite, after all, why do you lock your front door at night? That any good professional thief could probably pick your lock. What you want to do is make it just difficult enough so they don't bother you. They give up and they go down the street and try somebody else.
Yeah, they want to pick that lock right away. They don't want to be sitting there on the Ring camera for 2 or 3 minutes while the homeowner on the monitor end is notifying the authorities.
Exactly, exactly. And just the way it's playing out in cybersecurity. And just because you are in a small town or a rural part of the state, you can still be a target. The governor of North Dakota, in one of our workshops there, he said they found that the Russians were trying to get into a small school system in a rural county in North Dakota. And he said, now, that puzzled us. Why would they be spending any effort to get into that school system? And it turned out what they were trying to do was to get into the school, to get into the laptops and the cell phones of the students. The students then take the phones home. Now they can get to the parents' home networks. And then they can look around and see, well, what are the parents doing? Are they anybody interesting? And they said, maybe they're involved in elections. He said, but in North Dakota, one of their parents could also be working out a Minuteman missile base. Mm-hmm. So he said, you never know who's out there trying to get into your system.
No. Somewhat troubling and concerning input from you today, but also points of good news in regards to cybersecurity and the role that you and your team are playing in not only helping improve America's sort of curiously low position in terms of the pecking order of the most cybersecure elections and election systems on the planet, but nonetheless working toward making that better. Adam Clayton Powell III is Executive Director of the Election Cybersecurity Initiative at USC's Annenberg Center on Communication, Leadership, and Policy. He was recently up here in Connecticut leading workshops on cybersecurity for election officials. Adam, always good to talk with you, and we will look toward November and our fall elections with some renewed interest and certainly a lot more information. Thanks to you. Well, when last we left our friend Marcia Proto, who's executive director of the Connecticut Center for a Nursing Workforce, in part, we are talking about a major proposal, $26 million proposal for a very comprehensive move toward addressing and hopefully mitigating sooner than later kind of an emergency situation. Really, Marcia, I would imagine saying it was an emergency situation even maybe underselling it a little bit. Connecticut is facing a nursing situation that can have huge implications on healthcare delivery and public health. And you kind of saw where the puck was going to go and skated right toward it. And a lot has happened since we talked last. But welcome to the program, and thanks for joining us.
John, thank you for inviting me to the show. It's been actually since, I think, February of 2020 since I had joined you last. And yes, lots of exciting things have happened. And I love your analogy. You know, we need to skate to where the puck is going to be passed, not where it is currently. And so many of the innovations and infrastructure development projects that are happening and that have really come to fruition over the last 6 to 8 months are really going to put us where we need to skate to.
Yeah. Well, so, before we, yeah,
today.
Yeah, yeah. Before we talk about how you are, you know, cleverly and effectively allocating some of the funds that have either come to your organization or that you have been appointed steward of, the big news is that when last we talked, you were overseeing and kind of straddling both the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce and the Connecticut League for Nursing, but now all those two organizations have become one.
Yes, and actually we're excited to share, John, that on June 30th of 2022, the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce, who is its own 501c3 independent in Connecticut, merged, and we secured the organization of the Connecticut League for Nursing. So the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce, or as we like to be referred to as CCNW, has absorbed the programming and infrastructure and wonderful work that the Connecticut League for Nursing has done for the past 70 years in the state of Connecticut. And it's interesting how you mentioned that we've had some wonderful leaders who have been straddling, in addition to my staff of three, but straddling both organizations, really to put forth a vision and a mission of how we can address not only the nursing education pipelines, which was the sweet spot for the Connecticut League for Nursing, but how we dovetail and integrate those into the overarching building a robust and sustainable nursing workforce. So they kind of go hand in glove. And now having us branded as the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce, which will engage with the data work that we do, as well as innovative nursing education programs to meet our gaps in the workforce. We're very excited to speak now with one voice. And I think, as we mentioned earlier, before we got on, whenever I would go to a statewide meeting, people would look at me and say, who are you representing today?
Which hat are you wearing?
Yeah.
Well, I imagine the connectivity now between the two and actually becoming one is going to also enhance the flow of talent that come into and through the education side of nursing, and put them sort of the moment they engage in the educational side as a result of this merger, they will also have the benefit of immediately having their foot in the career development and placement and direction initiative.
John, that is so well said. You know, for quite a while, we've had online education program that helps nurses with transition from one role to another. You may remember for 20 years, we've had a very successful RN refresher course for nurses who are licensed but haven't practiced. Many employers ask them to take a refresher course. And we've run a very successful 17-week faculty-led online course for the past 20 years. It's 17 weeks in length, and so that gets people back into practice. And then we've also run for the past 13 years a successful course that actually takes nurses who want to teach in the clinical faculty role, bringing students into the clinical experiences in their juniors and senior years, to gain those so vital clinical hours, we've run a just-in-time clinical faculty prep course. And so, again, changing and transitioning nurses from one role to another. And we're very excited to share that through funds from the Eva Stern Faulkner Foundation that we just received this year, we're actually designing and creating a full-time nurse faculty prep course to get doctorally prepared nurses, whether they have their doctor in nursing practice or PhD, positioned to become full-time nursing faculty, whether it be in the classroom or in a hybrid or virtual environment. So this is very exciting because, as you know, the best prepared nurse may not be the best academician, and that's what we're trying to do to make these nurses successful in the full-time faculty role, which, as you know, you and I discussed ages ago. Such in demand and the linchpin for us to increase the seats for our nursing students in Connecticut.
I'm glad you brought that up, Marcia, because as nurses tend to specialize or at least develop passions in certain areas of care, it is important to note that the continuity of bringing nurses who are younger and energized or at least young in terms of their academic status right into advanced training for faculty prep and then into a faculty situation, is in fact very similar to, individual nurses going into specialized areas of care. This is just a specialty in teaching.
Exactly. And you and I can reflect on our experiences when we were students, whether it be at the undergrad or grad level, and really looking at the impact that our faculty plus the external or internship experiences that we've had really prepared us well for when we entered the workforce in our new role. And this is exactly what we want all of our faculty to be, on the top of their game. How to effectively assess students and place them in their clinical experiences and evaluate them, as well as when they're full-time, making sure with the ever-changing content in healthcare that our faculty are prepared to be able to engage that content, deliver that content to the student, be able to have them reflect, act on it, and build competencies and confidence in these areas of care. So we're so excited related to these just-in-time programs and how they can benefit all of our schools and programs of nursing in Connecticut.
Yeah, it really releases the best possible optimally trained nursing candidates into the workforce with the best trained instructors. And at that point, they can be mentored by those who are specializing in the day-to-day hands-on work in whatever area of nursing they may choose to go into, from critical care to geriatrics to even research, right?
Exactly. And we do have some of our hospitals being pretty, as you said, skating to where the puck should be, that they're realizing what potential gaps they may have in their workforce. And they're looking at projected retirements of some of their incumbent workers. And remember, you and I even talked about this. Even before COVID, a lot of nurses were reevaluating and reassessing the role to figure out where they wanted to practice and could they sustain the 12-hour shifts and the overtime and even mandatory overtime that was even occurring before COVID. And so they looked at their employee population and said, we're going to need some more operating room nurses. So you may have heard that Hartford Healthcare and Quinnipiac University have created a partnership, and they're looking at one of their cohorts of nursing students to get more intense experience in the operating room. So when these nurses graduate, they can make a seamless entry into the operating room with more, mentoring and coaching.
Right, right.
But before, it usually takes about a year to create an operating room nurse. So that wasn't a seamless transition.
Right.
But now employers and schools are becoming much more savvy to say, where are my gaps? And how can I create education pathways that will seamlessly transition that new grad into a high-need area?
Right.
So it's very exciting. Yale New Haven Health, they've been working with a couple schools to do the same thing in different disciplines. So it's very exciting what employers are doing And then the big exciting project is in May of 22, our Connecticut legislature did pass a $35 million initiative for nursing as well as behavioral health to enhance nursing education pipelines and workforce. So this is groundbreaking focus on nurses and behavioral health that has never happened before. And so it's going to be exciting within the next few months. Our schools are going to be getting an opportunity to really reflect to say, what infrastructure did they need, whether it be full-time, part-time faculty, simulated teaching and learning resources, transition of practice supports, to expand their student seat capacity by 20% over 3 years. So this is going to be a phenomenal opportunity for our schools and programs of nursing, as well as those behavioral health programs and social work in our state, to really identify what is unique within their organizations, that if they get resources, can they move the needle?
And we can't let you go without also asking folks out there, especially those who are registered nurses, to pencil themselves in for a little bit of networking and continuing education and inspiration as November arrives.
Oh, yes, John, thank you. I almost forgot. So believe it or not, the Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce is hosting our 42nd annual RN Student Day. And this is targeted at senior level nursing students and or new graduates. And it's a day of, as you alluded to, professional development. It's going to be a 2-day live virtual event packed with education programming, the designated exhibitor time, and some recognition activities. We have been running it virtually for the past 3 years and have attracted over 650 senior nursing students. And we currently are looking for any employer who wishes to be an exhibitor or sponsor. And so within those 2 days, we have an opportunity for real-time meet and greets. So they can share with the future nursing pipeline what type of opportunities they have. They can also use that time for one-on-one interviews. And then the interesting thing about the virtual platform that we couldn't do when we used to hold it live was we have 6 months of two-way communication between our exhibitor sponsors and our attendees. So our employers can send direct emails to share information about potential open houses or clinical shadow days or employment opportunities to really stoke and cultivate their nursing pipeline for 2023. So that is happening November 1st and 2nd live. And we, on our website, ctcenterfornursingworkforce.com, we have all of the information and the registration links.
Excellent. Bringing things full circle from the first subject of our conversation this morning, Marcia, getting back to the recent merger between CCNW and the Connecticut League for Nursing, what will people in the profession and those who support it be seeing in terms of pending changes to help CCNW become even, you know, more vibrant and top of mind among the professionals that you both serve and the workforce partners that you hope to supply?
That is a great question. We've reconstituted our board of directors. We're going through a brand new rebranding campaign with a revised mission and value proposition. Currently, we're looking for anybody who would like to be a nursing workforce partner. We're trying to attract not only the schools and programs of nursing who have always been our partners in the education realm, but those in practice to really look at where we can insert ourselves to make real-time change. So we're looking for partners right now to participate, and we give them some great exposure amongst the community. We just created a job board, John, in response to our employers and our schools wanting another opportunity to share what openings they have. We have a wonderful partnership with many of the agencies within the state of Connecticut, towns around the state who are posting their jobs, everything for community nurse and public health nurse to school nurses,
right?
So we're really trying to bridge the gap.
Excellent. Well, Marcia, great to chat with you again, and I can't wait to revisit in a few months to find out how all of this is gaining traction under the new merger. The Connecticut Center for Nursing Workforce now working both in the workforce development and educational realm, fostering collaboration and facilitating research on nursing and healthcare professions so that Connecticut has a robust, sustainable, diverse, and exceptional healthcare workforce in the future. Marcia, thanks so much for being part of the show this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.